Good evening. Boris Johnson glides to an easy win in British elections, apparently. Climate justice advocates witness government brutality against protesters in Chile. And Coca-Cola sucks up the water in an indigenous community in southern Mexico. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with some of the news for Thursday, December 12, 2019. Exit polls are indicating that Boris Johnson's Conservative Party will secure a decisive majority in Britain's third general election in 6 years. The Conservatives have been forecast to win 368 seats, a majority of over 80, with Labour suffering major losses and down to only 191 seats. The number one issue was the unresolved dilemma facing Britain as it tries to leave the European Union, known as Brexit. It won't be all smooth sailing for Johnson, however, as he must still face the challenge of negotiating an acceptable trade deal with the European Union by December 31st, 2020. Johnson's main opponent, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, had promised higher public spending, nationalisation of key services, taxes on the wealthy, and a new referendum on Brexit. Johnson, the New York-born former mayor of London, won the top job in July. His predecessor, Theresa May, resigned after failing to get parliamentary backing for her Brexit deal with the EU and then losing her party's majority in a snap election. Now to more of today's headlines with Linda Perry.
Thanks, Paul. The green light law, it's about to take effect. Immigrants without legal documents will finally be able to apply for driver's licenses in New York starting on Monday. License applicants without a valid Social Security number will be able to submit multiple alternative forms of ID that include valid passports issued in other countries. But immigrants might still face hurdles in some parts of the state. Some county clerks ideologically opposed to the law have challenged it in court and offered unclear messages this week on whether they'll be issuing licenses under the new program. The major victory for the green light law was led by immigrant New Yorkers who knocked on thousands of doors, collected thousands of petitions, held numerous community forums, and traveled countless times to Albany to share their stories with New York state legislators. The new law is expected to impact more than 700,000 undocumented immigrants who will be newly eligible to apply for a driver's license. In other news, New Jersey Attorney General Gerber Gruwald says authorities are investigating the shooting in Jersey City as an act of domestic terrorism. Gruwald told a news conference today that authorities believe the attack was fueled both by anti-Semitism and anti-law enforcement beliefs. A law enforcement official says the two killers who stormed the kosher market had apparently been followers of the Black Hebrew Israelites. That's a fringe group whose members have been known to rail against white people and Jews. The official was not authorized to discuss the case publicly and spoke on conditions of anonymity. The killers and four victims died in the attack on Tuesday. Meanwhile, New York police have increased patrols around Columbia University, the campus there, and a nearby park. This after an 18-year-old college freshman was fatally stabbed. Barnard College's president said in a letter to the campus that Tessa Majors was fatally injured during an armed robbery in the park on Wednesday. The Daily News says the teen's parents live in Charlottesville, Virginia. Barnard College is part of Columbia University. And New York's ban on flavored e-cigarettes is still held up in court, but the state is moving to keep it alive and could expand it to include menthol. The state's Public Health and Health Planning Council voted today to keep the emergency ban on the books for another 90 days. The council approved the ban in September, but a state appeals court blocked the state from enforcing it in October. Critics sued the state over the ban, calling it government overreach that would hurt small businesses. Some adult smokers said flavors helped them quit. And trains were delayed last night because a 2-year-old boy was killed after being struck by a subway in Manhattan. The New York Daily News reports the toddler was hit by an uptown number 2 train during rush hour on Wednesday at the Fulton Street station after he slipped away from his mom on the platform. New York police officers freed the child from underneath the train and rushed him to a hospital where he was pronounced dead. Officials have not released the name of the child or his mom. The death caused the MTA to announce a number of train delays last night. And turning to the Harvey Weinstein settlement, Weinstein and his former studio's board have reached a tentative $25 million settlement with dozens of his sexual misconduct accusers. Chicago attorney Elizabeth Fagan said at least 29 actresses and former Weinstein employees, along with the New York Attorney General's office, have agreed to the deal that would end nearly every lawsuit brought against him and his company. The New York Times reports that Weinstein would avoid paying any of his own money and would not be required to admit any wrongdoing as part of the deal. Lawyers for Weinstein did not return messages. A lawyer for the Weinstein Company declined comment. Turning now to Jeffrey Epstein, a lawyer for Epstein's estate, says he's disappointed that women who say the financier sexually attacked them aren't suspending lawsuits to join a special compensation fund. Attorney Bennett Moskowitz told a Manhattan federal judge on Wednesday that women instead are moving full steam ahead with their lawsuits. A lawyer for one of the women says she has very low confidence in the integrity of the process set up by the estate to compensate victims. More than a dozen lawsuits are seeking compensation for women who say they were abused at Epstein's homes in Manhattan, Florida, New Mexico, the Virgin Islands, and Paris. Back over to you, Paul.
Thanks, Linda. And you're listening to the news on locally produced and independent WBAI in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In national news, the House on Thursday passed a sweeping bill aimed at lowering prescription drug prices, a step toward a long-held Democratic goal that was met with sharp Republican resistance. The bill passed on a largely party-line vote of 230 to 192. The measure, which would allow the government to negotiate lower prices for prescription drugs, is one of the House Democrats' top priorities and is expected to be touted by vulnerable Democrats up for re-election next year. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi earlier today.
In my travels across the country, I've seen grown men cry about how they cannot meet the needs of their families when it comes to prescription drug costs. Spouse with long-term illness, children with chronic diseases, and the rest. Prescription drug prices are out of control. The price of insulin, invented nearly a century ago, when people say we have to cover our research costs, invented nearly a century ago, doubled from 2012 to 2016 because of big pharma's need. Many people use it. A lot of people buy it. Let's increase our profits, they say. Americans are paying four times or more for what Big Pharma charges for the exact drugs in other countries. While Big Pharma companies reap record-breaking profits and multi-billion-dollar windfalls from the GOP tax scam, 58 million Americans couldn't afford to fill a prescription they needed to stay healthy in the past year. 58 million Americans. 34 million Americans know a loved one who died from not being able to afford a treatment that they needed. We face medical, economic, and moral crisis that demands that we act and that we act boldly. Yes, they have a motion to recommit, and that I think that it was appropriate that the Republicans have the opportunity to put an alternative on the floor. Incremental pieces, not going to the heart of the matter. How dare they ever think of enabling the secretary to negotiate for lower prices, which is the heart of the matter. We've been trying to do this for a number of years. Today we will.
Pelosi tried for months to win Trump's support for the bill. The president had broke from Republican orthodoxy and supported government negotiation on drug prices during his 2016 campaign. But after months of talks between Pelosi's staff and the White House, the administration opposed the measure, leading Democrats to say Trump is breaking his promise to support negotiation for lower prices. And another type of drug took center stage in the House today as the House Judiciary Committee resumed debate on two articles of impeachment against President Trump ahead of final votes on them expected later today. The full House is expected to vote on them next week, making Trump just the third president in U.S. history to be impeached. The Senate Majority Leader says he expects a trial in the Republican-controlled upper chamber in January. A two-thirds vote would be needed to remove the president from office. In one exchange today, a GOP member, Matt Gaetz of Florida, cast aspersions on former Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter, mentioning an account of the younger Biden's struggle with drugs.
In Los Angeles for about a week, he said that he needed to get away and forget sooner after his arrival in L.A. He said he asked a homeless man in Pershing Square where he could buy crack. Hunter said that the man took him to a nearby homeless encampment where a narrow passageway between tents, someone put a gun to his head before realizing that he was the buyer. He returned to buy more crack a few times that week. Again, not saying, you know, not casting any judgment on any challenges someone goes through in their personal life, but it is just hard to believe that this was the guy wandering through homeless encampments buying crack that was worth $86,000 a month to Burisma Holding.
Prompting a defense by Georgia Democrat Hank Johnson.
The pot calling the kettle black is not something that we should do. I don't know what members, if any, have had any problems with substance abuse, been busted in DUI. I don't know. But if I did, I wouldn't raise it against anyone on this committee. I don't think it's proper.
Meanwhile, an executive order by Trump yesterday has sparked controversy. The order would threaten federal funding to schools that support groups promoting the boycott, sanctions, and divest movement that targets Israel's treatment of Palestinians. Sandra Tamari is director of Adala Justice Project.
The executive order that was just signed yesterday is trying to demonize and make punishable any kind of advocacy on behalf of Palestinians and their rights. It's directly targeted at Palestinians and their allies on college campuses, but it's disguised as protecting Jewish students and fighting anti-Semitism, which is a very dangerous conflation. The idea that speaking out against Israeli abuses of Palestinian rights as somehow being anti-Semitic inherently is the goal, and it really is meant to cause a chilling effect on the way that students are organizing so effectively for Palestinian rights.
What effect might it have from your perspective on people who are in the BDS movement, for example, or others who are advocating for Palestinian justice?
Well, I mean, I think that it really leaves things very open. Obviously, it's going to be very hard to recruit students to join chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine. They're going to feel, you know, that somehow their work will be scrutinized by campus administration. It's not a new thing for Palestine activism to be, you know, targeted on university campuses. But what this does is it incentivizes college administrations to really clamp down on this kind of speech. Speech that's protected, obviously, but it'll be a way that these campuses will target activism for Palestinian rights, boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns against Israel. With this EO behind them saying that we will lose our federal funding potentially if we allow this kind of speech to continue.
Yeah, and how would they? Is there any way of what do they mean by this? You know, what would trigger? Do we know? Let me put it this way: do we know what would trigger a federal government withdrawal of funds to a university?
We don't know exactly. I think that this is all going to be open to interpretation. What the EEO says is that this kind of definition of what anti-Semitism entails, including criticism of the Israeli state, should be considered when looking at cases or charges of anti-Semitism on campus. And what Kushner is trying to say in his op-ed is that this EEO is to protect Jewish students. Jewish students are a protected class on campus. They are part of all protected classes under Title VI, going back to 1964. This is not a new thing. Anti-Semitism must be fought on campus, and it's a growing threat. But the threat is not coming from Palestine activists. The threat is coming from the White House and coming from white nationalists. That's what's being used so cynically right now. On most campuses, chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine include Palestinians and Jewish students that are linked arm in arm to stand together for freedom, equality, and justice. And what we're seeing here is an old tactic of divide and conquer. Right now, it's so urgent for us to unite in the face of the real anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, anti-immigrant and racist policies coming from the White House.
This seems to divide Jewish people from those who want to see justice for Palestinians, from those who are more strictly Zionist, more than it does even Palestinians and Jewish people.
Absolutely. I think that the Trump administration is using tactics that are age old, and they really are trying to divide people that are fighting oppression from each other.
The BDS movement, what it really is about and how widespread it is on campus and what effect it's been having.
The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, it comes from a call that Palestinian civil society put out in 2005, asking for international solidarity in the form of economic measures to hold Israel accountable to upholding the rights of Palestinians. It's very clear that they're upholding the rights of Palestinians to live in freedom, an end to the military occupation, for equality for Palestinians who are citizens of the State of Israel, and for the return of Palestinian refugees that have been denied return to their homes. BDS is a nonviolent movement that on college campuses has involved boycotting Israeli products that are being sold perhaps in a cafeteria or in a store. It involves divestment campaigns, asking university portfolios to be divested from companies that are supporting the Israeli military, and a call for sanctions for the U.S. government to withdraw its support of the Israeli military in the form of $3.8 billion per year.
Anything you'd like to add?
Palestinians in the U.S. have, you know, just this week launched a vision platform called Freedom is the Future. And the National Students for Justice in Palestine Network endorsed that platform. It's a call for universal demands for freedom and self-determination, the right of refugees to return to their homeland, a space to thrive, and safety for all people. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see, you know, as students are embracing this platform, as students are embracing this platform, it'll be interesting to see, you know, what will college administrations say? Because the platform is a call for justice. It's a call for equality. This kind of, you know, platform, if students are lifting up this kind of platform, that should be applauded and not punished.
Sandra Tamari is director of Adala Justice Project. And earlier this week, 16-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, earning a Trump tweet denigrating the achievement. Trump told Thunberg to chill out. Thunberg responded by posting that she, in fact, was chill. But Ann Peterman, director of Global Justice Ecology Project, is in the nation of Chile, the nation originally tapped to host COP25, the UN-sponsored climate conference, but because of extensive violence was moved to Madrid in Spain. Peterman reports on conditions in Chile for WBAI earlier today.
To many mobilizations of the people here, marches on human rights, marches for women's rights, marches for all kinds of things, and we've seen the repression by the police, not just here in Santiago, but down in southern Chile in Temuco, and even out in Mapuche territory. The Mapuche are the indigenous people here. They're rising up to take back their land. And, all you know, the repression from the authorities has been incredibly, ridiculously over the top. And yet the response from the people who are rising up is this incredible jubilance and joy and love. And I mean, it sounds very corny to say it that way, but it's incredible. You can't imagine it unless you're here. And we're so happy and honored to have been part of this struggle, if even for a few weeks.
Peterman says it's notable that as Greta Thunberg addresses the United Nations, the host of the climate talks is attacking student protesters.
I felt it was ironic. You know, Greta is this great spokesperson for youth, and she was talking. She got the Time Magazine Person of the Year award yesterday, and she was speaking to the UN about this and, you know, talking about the need for both optimism and outrage. And at the same time, you know, there's this 15-year-old girl from Chile in the hospital in critical condition because of the actions of the government that is running the climate COP. So I felt that was very ironic. And yes, it would be very powerful if she would make some kind of statement that is not okay, and that, you know, Chile should not have been allowed to run the climate COP. You know, and that the climate COP should actually do something and take action. What they did yesterday, in fact, was shut out all of civil society. So, you know, Greta got this award, and she was speaking to the UN, and then the UN kicked out all of civil society for a mass protest because they were standing up for climate justice and climate action.
Peterman says it's time for Chile to step down from hosting the climate change events.
Here we are, 50-plus days into this uprising, and it's still happening. And so Chile decided it could not hold the COP here, in part because of that uprising, and in part because of the go-ahead that the national police had been given here to use extreme violence against the protesters. And so the main injury that's been happening to protesters here in Chile who have risen up against the neoliberal model is eye injuries, because the police are using shotguns and shooting at people's faces with these rubber-coated metal pellets. So they're calling them rubber bullets and saying they're less lethal, but in fact what they are is, you know, they're blinding people. Many people have lost eyes because they're intentionally shooting at people's faces.
Ann Peterman is director of Global Justice Ecology Project, and she's reporting to us at WBAI exclusively from Chile. Meanwhile, in southern Mexico, in the state of Chiapas, a heavily indigenous Mayan community, the people say their water is being stolen by the Coca-Cola company. Laura Miebert is a assistant professor of politics and an anthropologist, and she says that it's becoming a very, very serious problem.
There is a Coca-Cola plant, the western side of the city of San Cristóbal de las Casas, which is the main city in that region of Mexico. The main objection and the source of the tensions with that Coca-Cola plant is that the relationship with Coca-Cola is unfair in a couple of different ways. There's a legal tradition in Mexico dating to the time of the Mexican Revolution that established water as the communal property of the Mexican people, and that specifically guaranteed that households would be given first priority entitlement to water use. After that would come agricultural use, and water for industrial purposes was at the bottom of the list. However, in 1992, that arrangement was turned on its head by the Ley de Aguas Nacionales, the National Water Law, which created CONAGUA, the National Water Commission in Mexico. It also gave CONAGUA the authority to act as sole gatekeeper to sell private companies like Coca-Cola concessions to dig private deep wells. It allowed companies like Coca-Cola to tap directly into aquifers and extract truly massive quantities of water for just a nominal fee payable to the federal government, which Coca-Cola began doing in San Cristobal in 1995. Under this arrangement, since 1992, local governments, including the local government in San Cristobal, they have no authority to say that a company like Coca-Cola can't come to town and have VIP access to the area's aquifer, better access even than the area's local residents. So what we've got now is a situation where the local people and the local government have no democratic recourse to tell Coca-Cola no. And meanwhile, Coca-Cola enjoys privileged access to water. There are actually neighborhoods in San Cristobal that are poor and that are primarily inhabited by urban indigenous people that only have access to running water a couple times a week. And all the while, the Coca-Cola factory's private wells keep it perpetually supplied with pure water.
Is there a drought? What's the actual conditions that cause it to be such a water shortage area?
The Huitepec Hill, which is a, I guess in English we would call it a mountain, that is at the very edge of San Cristobal, which, and the Coca-Cola factory is located at the base of this mountain. This is known as a water hill to the people there. It is known as a traditionally water-rich area. So the engineers that I've spoken to, there's some controversy among the ones that I've spoken to about exactly what is the hydrology of this. The farmers who I spoke to reported that the more Coca-Cola has intensified its extraction of groundwater, the lower the levels of water in these farmers' wells have fallen. And they find that they have to dig their wells deeper and deeper to reach water. And it strikes them as unfair that they have to suffer these consequences.
And people almost have a reverence for Fanta, Coke, Pepsi. It's become, strangely enough, part of their religion. Does that have something to do with this?
In the highlands of Chiapas, there is a very strong alcoholic beverage that people make locally that's called posh. And posh is made from corn, and it's a clear liquor that hits you very, very quickly when you drink it. And posh traditionally plays an important role in religious ceremonies in Mayan communities. At certain points in the ceremony, including syncretic Catholic ceremonies, there's a communion where a cup of posh is ceremonially passed around and everyone present is given a sip one after the other. Some communities who disapprove of or even forbid alcohol consumption, including consumption of posh, including religiously Protestant communities, politically Zapatista communities, either cannot or prefer not to use posh for their own reasons. And so they use Coca-Cola in these ceremonies instead. That has a lot to do with Coca-Cola's heavy influence and marketing in rural communities in the highlands dating back to the 1960s.
And Laura Meebert is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Kittering University. And that's some of the news for Thursday, December 12, 2019. The news is produced with Linda Perry, our engineers, Reggie Johnson, from the studios of listener-sponsored, locally produced, and independent WBAI News. I'm Paul D'Arienzo.